Welcome to Then and Now with Ed Stevens, President of the International Preterist Association. Then and Now is a weekly podcast designed to explore past fulfillment of Bible prophecy in order to equip us for guiding the church in its ongoing reform. And now, with today's message, here's Ed Stevens.
Welcome to our ongoing study of the resurrection from a full preterist perspective. Last time, we looked at the expectations of the pre-70 saints, especially in regard to their hope of being transformed or changed to be like Christ when they saw him appear at the Parousia. We discussed several of the biblical texts which indicate what the first century saints were expecting to see, hear, and experience at the Parousia, as well as what the transformation or bodily change was all about. The PDF lesson outline for that study was over 40 pages, including material from my magazine articles and seminar speeches. If you have not taken a look at it yet, you will certainly want to do so. It is the equivalent of a small book. It has lots of material that you will not find anywhere else. In this session, we will try to finish our study of Paul's resurrection teaching in both of his letters to the Corinthians. I want to tie up any loose ends that we may have left dangling in our previous studies and give an overview, the big picture, of what Paul was teaching the Corinthians about the resurrection and change event at the Parousia. Let's ask our Heavenly Father for His blessing on our study together. Our physical creator and spiritual progenitor, the only eternal, self-existing, omniscient, and omnipotent One who sovereignly rules the whole universe in both its seen and unseen realms, we exalt and adore Your infinitely high and holy name. We are here to study Your inspired and absolutely authoritative Word. May Your Spirit in our hearts teach us Your truth as we study it together. We ask for this in the name of Your only begotten Son, Jesus. Amen. Here is a quick overview of what Paul talks about here in 1 Corinthians 15. Before we get into a detailed explanation of it, I wanted to give us a quick overview. First of all, he says in verses 1 through 11, he tells them about the gospel that he had preached to those Corinthians and reminds them that they had believed this very gospel that he had preached to them. But now, some there in Corinth were denying that the dead would be raised out of Hades and were questioning the idea of a bodily afterlife. Paul argues that if the dead cannot be raised out of Hades, then neither was Christ raised out of Hades. The resurrection deniers there at Corinth raised two big questions for Paul to address in verse 35. The first question was, and I'm going to read some possible ways we can translate it, but it literally says, "How are the dead raised?" There's several ways to translate that present passive indicative form of agiro there. It could be translated this way, and this is probably the way that I would prefer to translate it. The question would read this way: "How can the dead be raised?" Or, "How do the dead rise?" That's taking a gnomic question of principle or statement of principle or a well-known fact into account as we translate that. This gnomic sense seems to work best in connection with the second question, which is, what kind of body do they come? And so, if we use this gnomic sense of the present passive indicative form of agiro here, then I think it'll work best with that question. That means that their two questions could be stated this way: how in the world can the dead ones be raised back out of Hades? And if they do rise out of Hades, what kind of body do they have when they come forth from Hades? I think that makes the most sense out of all the different possible ways to translate that present passive indicative form of agiro. There are a couple of other ways to do it, though. It could be translated as a futuristic present tense. by this way of wording the question, it would be, how are the dead to be raised? Or it could be translated in an iterative series of individual resurrections sense by saying it this way, how are the dead being raised at the present time? A series of individual resurrections. But I think in view of the second question, where they're asking about the kind of body, it would make a lot more sense to believe that the first question is questioning the actual possibility of a resurrection out of Hades. And then the second question says, if so, if there's going to be a resurrection, what kind of bodies are they going to have when they come forth out of Hades? So I think the gnomic sense is probably the best way of handling that first question so that it works real well and logically and clearly with the second question. Well, Paul goes on to answer both of those questions using a seed analogy. After proving that the dead will be raised in a future tense and that they will have a new kind of body that is suited to life in heaven, Paul then turns his attention to those living saints who would remain alive at the time of the parousia when the dead would be raised. And then he talks in the second section there about what's going to happen to the living saints after he finishes his argument for the resurrection of the dead saints. And here in this second section of Paul's comments about the resurrection, where he deals with the living saints and what's going to happen to them, the bodily change, he reveals another mystery to the Corinthians about that bodily change that the living would experience at the parousia. The dead would be raised, but the living saints would be changed. That's a mystery that had not been clearly revealed in the Old Testament, which Paul clears up for them and unveils for their understanding. And so, very interesting here how he brings the change, the bodily change, into the discussion after he has finished talking about the resurrection and answering the two questions of those resurrection deniers there. Well, we probably need to deal with these resurrection deniers. Who were they? What kind of philosophical or theological perspective were they coming from? Why were they denying the resurrection? On what basis? So the interpretation of 1 Corinthians 15 to a large degree depends on who these resurrection deniers were and what kind of concept of resurrection they were coming from. If we can identify who they were, then we will know why Paul frames his arguments the way he does and what he is trying to prove with those arguments. In other words, interpreting Paul's statements here becomes a lot easier once we know who he is debating against. Who were those some there at Corinth who were denying the resurrection of the dead out of Hades? One listener posed the question this way. Did the error and ignorance of those resurrection deniers originate from Greek thought, which taught a bodiless existence after death? Or was that ignorance and error and confusion coming from the Sadducees, who denied a resurrection and afterlife both? In other words, were these resurrection deniers Jewish Sadducees who denied not only a resurrection but a conscious afterlife as well? Or were they Gnostics who denied a resurrection but believed in a conscious afterlife in a disembodied pure spirit state? Or were they simple Jewish or Gentile Christians there in Corinth who had been confused in their thinking by listening too much to the Greek philosophers right there in Corinth who denied a resurrection, even though they believed in a conscious afterlife, which was a disembodied pure spirit state, and accepted the possibility that some special heroes, such as Jesus, could have been raised out of Hades as an exception to the general rule that the dead do not rise? Well, I'm going to argue for the third option here. When we analyze Paul's use of terminology and the style of his argumentation, It appears that he is debating someone who was familiar with the teachings of the Greek philosophers like Plato and Aristotle. Paul applies the label foolish. In the Greek, that's aphron. Paul applies that label of foolish to those at Corinth who were denying the resurrection of the dead. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 36. That was a label that the Greek philosophers loved to slap on their debate opponents. Paul may have been reversing the charges here in calling them foolish. Paul also uses a couple of quotes from Greek philosophers in his argumentation. See 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32 and 33, where he talks about, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die," which is a quote from one of the philosophers, as well as his statement, "Bad company corrupts good morals," which is another quote from another one of the Greek philosophers. Paul uses these two quotes here in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32 and 33. If his opponents there at Corinth were Sadducees, those quotes of heathen Greek philosophers would not have been authoritative to the Sadducees. But if the resurrection deniers there were Gnostics or Greeks, those quotes would have had some leverage in his debate with them. Thus it seems that the main problem here at Corinth was coming from a Greek philosophical perspective. The Greeks had real difficulty with any kind of bodily afterlife, since they viewed the body as an evil prison which they wished to be rid of in the afterlife. They viewed the body as necessarily evil. Therefore, an afterlife would not be in a body. Paul agrees partially with them that the bodies we now have cannot be used in the afterlife, in verse 50, where he says, "Flesh and blood cannot inherit the heavenly kingdom," and where he says, "Corruption cannot inherit incorruption." Now notice the contrast in his referring to the body as corruptible or corruption and not evil. See, the Greeks would have referred to the body as evil. Paul only goes halfway there and says that it's corruptible and corrupt because of our sin, but it's not evil. And so there's an interesting contrast there. He's trying to clue the Greeks in on the fact that their concept of the body is not correct. It's not biblically correct. And so Paul corrects that understanding of the body as being evil by showing that it's not evil in fact, but rather just corrupted by sin in this life, and therefore it needs to put on incorruption in order to be the kind of body that they could have in the afterlife. So Paul shows their fallacy in denying a bodily afterlife when he states that there are different kinds of bodies and that their afterlife would be in bodies that were made in the image of the heavenly man, Christ Jesus. Not all bodies are subject to corruption. This is where the Greeks misunderstood the afterlife. They think that all bodies were evil. And Paul corrects their understanding by showing that, no, not all bodies are subject to corruption. Jesus was the first to have an incorruptible body, and he gives all of his saints an incorruptible body just like his for their afterlife in heaven. This was a possibility the Greeks had not thought much about. They rejected any kind of body in the afterlife since they viewed all bodies as necessarily evil. But Paul says there are different kinds of bodies, some corruptible and others incorruptible, and that their afterlife would be in an incorruptible and immortal body, not a corruptible or evil body. We certainly do not take our corrupted and corruptible bodies to heaven with us, but we do get a new uncorrupted and incorruptible body like Christ to dwell in heaven with. This is Paul's whole point in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 37 through 41. The opponents there at Corinth do not appear to be Gnostics, unless it was a very early, weak, and undeveloped form of Gnosticism, whose afterlife views were virtually the same as the Greek Platonic afterlife views. Paul does not challenge any of the other beliefs of Gnostics here, and the ideas he does challenge are common to both Greeks and Gnostics. So there is nothing here in Paul's arguments that would necessitate the conclusion that his opponents were Gnostics. But there is a lot here in 1 Corinthians 15 to support the idea that his opponents were, in fact, coming from a Greek philosophical view of the afterlife and not a Jewish view. All his quotes of these Greek philosophers would be totally out of place in a discussion with Sadducees or other Jewish opponents. And so, by the way Paul argues his case, it seems very clearly that he's dealing with Greek philosophical opponents, or those at Corinth who had been influenced by Greek philosophers. In his comments on Paul's afterlife teachings in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, which talks about the bodily change, Walter Smithels notes that Paul used terminology in his argumentation, which was also used by Greek Platonic philosophers and Gnostics alike. He says here, "The figure of the tent as the dwelling place of the I is widespread, especially since Plato, and is typically dualistic." Now, of course, he uses that argument to argue that the deniers here, resurrection deniers in Corinth, were Gnostics. But I just don't buy his argument because there's not enough of that kind of argumentation here in either 1st or 2nd Corinthians to justify the Gnostics being involved. Everything that applied to the Gnostics also applied to Greek philosophy in general. So I see this as being Greek philosophers or saints there at Corinth who had been influenced by Greek philosophers and not by Gnostics. Thus, Paul's argumentation in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, appears to be directed against Greek-oriented opponents who were arguing against the concepts of a resurrection out of Hades and a bodily afterlife. The Greeks, if they believed in a conscious afterlife, believed it would be forever in Hades in a disembodied state. Paul, in agreement with the Pharisees, believed that the righteous would be raised out of Hades and have a bodily afterlife. The Pharisees believed those two points. In view of this, it is quite surprising to most of us preterists when we find out that the collective body guys agree with the Greeks and the Gnostics that our afterlife is a disembodied pure spirit existence. Their claims to be in sync with the bodily afterlife taught by Paul and the Pharisees are simply not true. The only sense in which they believe in a bodily afterlife is in a collective body sense. They believe the individual disembodied soul or spirit is merged into the collective body and that it has no individual bodily experience in the afterlife. They believe the individual disembodied soul or spirit is merged into the collective body. That is the only sense in which they believe our afterlife is bodily. Does that sound more like Paul and the Pharisees? Or does it sound like the Greeks and the Gnostics' concept of the afterlife? There are several indicators here within the chapter of 1 Corinthians 15 which point toward the probability, if not the certainty, that Paul's opponents there at Corinth were coming from a Greek-oriented philosophical framework. And let's look at these. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32, he quotes a well-known Epicurean philosopher statement that reads, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." If Paul's opponents were Jewish, this quote of Epicurean Greek philosophers would have made no impact upon their argumentation. It would only be effective against Greek opponents. Quotes of Greek authors and philosophers like this would be totally out of place and meaningless in a debate about whether the Old Testament dead were going to be included in the collective body resurrection. According to the collective body theory, the resurrection deniers there at Corinth were not denying a resurrection and afterlife for everyone, but only for the Old Testament dead. If those Old Testament dead were not going to be raised, why would living saints abandon their afterlife hope to eat and drink and be merry for tomorrow they die? That argument would be meaningless if the discussion here is about a collective body, resurrection. And then in verse 32, Paul appears to be quoting from or alluding to the teachings of the Greek philosophers Menander, Aeschylus, or Diodorus Siculus when he says, "Bad company corrupts good morals." Again, if Paul's opponents were Jewish, and this whole discussion is a debate about a collective body, including the Old Testament Jewish dead, then quotes like this, "bad company corrupts good morals," would make no sense. Again, if Paul's opponents were Jewish, this quote of Greek authors would have no effect against their arguments, nor would it make any sense in the context of a collective body debate. Then in verses 36 through 44, Paul gives his seed analogy, and we need to note that this seed analogy was used by Greeks and Jews alike. But the particular form that he constructs here and uses in his analogy looks more like he is using the Greek form of it as it was developed by Plato, and then turns it against his Greek opponents. That makes a lot more sense if he's arguing against Greek-oriented deniers of the resurrection. The way he formulates this seed analogy would not be really effective against Gentile deniers of the Old Testament dead being a part of the collective body resurrection. It just really wouldn't work. It wouldn't make any sense in that context. And then in verse 36, Paul calls his opponents foolish, which was one of the labels that the Greek philosophers loved to slap on their debate opponents. And so it's not surprising that Paul would use that as a label of his opponents if, in fact, those opponents were Greek philosophers or influenced by Greek philosophers. Many of the Greeks in the first century held to the idea of immortality of the soul, which advocated a conscious afterlife, but in a disembodied pure spirit state without a body. They saw no value in having a body in their afterlife because they viewed the body as totally evil and worthless and even a detriment to their enjoyment of the afterlife. They viewed death as liberation from the evils of life in a body. Murdoch Dahl, in his book The Resurrection of the Body, thinks that the doubts about the resurrection that some there at Corinth had were exactly what one would expect to find in a Greek or Hellenistic community conditioned to believe that all matter is either evil or illusory, and who would tend to think of salvation in terms of the immortality of the soul. And Coleman, in his book, Immortality of the Soul or Resurrection of the Dead, notes that in Athens there was no laughter by the Epicureans until Paul spoke of the resurrection, and that for the Greeks who believed in the immortality of the soul without the body, it may have been harder to accept the Christian preaching of the resurrection than it was for others. A couple of very good insights there, I believe, on who these people were that Paul was trying to correct. Well, we need to note here also that Corinth was only 40 miles away from Athens. Both cities, Corinth and Athens, were strong centers of Greek culture and philosophy. Whatever was believed in Athens was almost always found in Corinth as well. So it would be no surprise to learn that the resurrection deniers in Corinth were coming from the same Greek philosophical perspective as Athens had. Murray Harris shows that there were several afterlife views among the Greeks, as witnessed by the Stoics, Epicureans, Pythagoreans, Platonists, and others. He says, "But the evidence of Greek epitaphs suggests that most Greek people shared vague Homeric ideas of the afterlife rather than having a Platonic or Pythagorean outlook. That is, apart from heroes and notorious sinners who had particular destinies suited to their deeds, people survived death simply as bodiless shades in Hades without any personal consciousness or identity. Such shadowy relics or doubles of former living persons had a permanent, changeless existence in Hades, unaffected by transmigration. Harris then explains the attitude that almost all Greeks had about the possibility of a resurrection back out of Hades. He says, "There are probably no lines anywhere in Greek literature that more aptly epitomize the prevailing Greek attitude toward resurrection than those found in the Eumenides of Aeschylus, lines 647 and 648. On the occasion of the founding of the court of the Areopagus in Athens, the god Apollo observes, 'Once a man is slain by death, and the dust has drunk up his blood, there is no coming back to life.'" And finally, then, Harris notes that there was considerable variety among the Greeks in their afterlife views, but almost all of them rejected the idea of resurrection, regardless of how it was defined. Harris mentions a couple of writers, Euripides and Plato, who acknowledged the possibility that the gods could raise the dead, but even in these exceptional cases, resurrection merely means reanimation of the physical body through the return of the soul from Hades. For instance, in Plato's works called the Symposium, he talks about that very concept. Many educated Greeks, however, aspired to immortality of the soul only, convinced by the persuasive reasoning of that unrepeatable succession of philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Well, with all that in mind about who Paul's opponents were there in Corinth, which we believe is Greek philosophers, and who it was that was confusing the saints there to think that the dead were not going to be raised, let us take now a quick journey through the whole chapter of 1 Corinthians 15 to see if it will make more sense for us now that we understand who Paul is arguing against. Also keep in mind that I am interpreting this text from an individual body perspective, not the collective body view. As we go through the chapter, we will point out some of the clues within the context that confirm that Paul is arguing his case against those Greek-influenced resurrection deniers there at Corinth. And we'll also point out some things that show that Paul is definitely not operating from a collective body perspective, that he is operating from an individual body perspective. We'll see those clues come out of the context as we study through this chapter. In verses 1 through 11, notice the four occurrences of the phrase, "he was seen," verses 5 through 8 especially. These are eyewitness confirmations of the reappearance of Jesus in his self-same crucified body. These reappearances were not a ghost out of Hades, or just a docetic resurrection of Jesus for evidentiary purposes. Nor were they merely metaphorical references to his collective body being raised out of covenantal sin death into the life of the kingdom. Instead, Paul said that Christ was raised out of Hades and reappeared in his self-same individual flesh and bones body that had died. Notice verse 11b, "So we preached, and so you believed." This is the gospel that Paul had preached to the Corinthians, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, which they received and stood in and believed. But in view of this confusion over the afterlife and the resurrection of the dead out of Hades and their reception of a new body in the afterlife, Paul wonders and hopes that they had not believed his gospel in vain. Well, in verses 12 through 19, Paul mentions that there were some at Corinth who were saying that there is no resurrection of the dead. But Paul reminded them that they had already believed his gospel, which taught that Jesus had been raised from the dead. So why did they now doubt that others could be raised? If Jesus was raised, as they supposedly believed, then others could also be raised. And conversely, if the dead ones in Hades could not be raised out of there, then neither was Jesus raised out of Hades. Yet they believed that Jesus had been raised. Paul said their faith in the resurrection of Christ was in vain and empty and futile in verse 2, 14, and 17, if there was no resurrection of the dead. This would also mean that the dead saints had simply perished, that all saints were still in their sins, and that their Christian lifestyle was the most pitiable. This is why he later says, "If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Their lifestyle was the most pitiable waste of their time on earth, if in fact there was no resurrection and no afterlife. Well, in verses 20 through 23, Paul argues that since Christ was the first fruit of the resurrection harvest, his resurrection guaranteed that the rest of the dead would be raised. When Christ ascended, the first fruit was presented to God, making it possible for the rest of the dead to be raised. Notice what Paul wrote in verses 22 and 23 regarding when the resurrection would occur. The dead saints had not yet been raised when Paul wrote in AD 57, but they shall be made alive, future tense, at the parousia. Very interesting there. Paul talks about the resurrection as something that would occur in the future at the parousia. They shall be made alive. The dead shall be made alive, future tense, at the parousia. It was not a process of resurrection that was already going on, like the collective body guys want to say. Paul says here that the dead would not be made alive until the parousia. This proves that the resurrection was not an ongoing process at the time Paul wrote, but rather a future event that would occur at the parousia. This future tense, shall be made alive, does not work in the collective body view of the resurrection at all, but it fits perfectly with the individual body view. In verses 24 through 28, Paul says that Christ was already reigning in some sense at the time he wrote in AD 57, and that Christ must continue to reign until all his enemies were put under his feet, verse 25. Now, we need to ask, what reign is this? In what sense was Jesus already reigning in heaven? This cannot be his eternal reign because he had to come back first before he could begin that eternal reign with the Father. And so, what reign is this that Paul is talking about? Could it be the millennial reign? That's the only other reign that our New Testament talks about, besides the eternal reign with the Father after the parousia. And this reign is happening before the parousia, and in the book of Revelation, chapter 20, that seems to fit into the millennial reign. It certainly cannot be his eternal reign, which did not begin until the parousia. So unless we want to posit two different reigns of Christ before his eternal reign, it means that this reign must be his millennial reign, during which he put down all of his enemies. This is very interesting if we compare this with 1 Kings chapter 5, verse 3, where it talks about David putting down all of his enemies. And then during this millennial reign, he took the kingdom away from the Jews, as Jesus tells us in his parable in Luke chapter 20, verse 16, as well as its parallel in Matthew 21, verse 43. He took the kingdom away from the Jews, gave it back to the Father to whom it belongs. And 1 Samuel 8, verse 7 tells us who the kingdom belonged to. Samuel was complaining about the Jews wanting a king, and that they had rejected him from being their ruler. And he's whining about that to God, and God reminds him, Samuel, it's not you that they've rejected from being king over them. It's me. I am their king. And so Jesus was putting down all those enemies, which were the Jews mainly, because the Jews were the ones who were persecuting the church. They were the ones who crucified Jesus as well and rejected him as being king over them. And so they're the ones that Jesus is going to take the kingdom back away from and give it back to the Father to whom it belongs. And then sit down with the Father to co-reign with him eternally. And he would accomplish that putting down of the enemies at his parousia, as we see in the book of Revelation. Very clearly shows the coming of Christ on a white horse to put down his enemies, the last of which is death itself. And we see that in Revelation chapter 20, where it talks about the final enemy of death and Hades being thrown into the lake of fire after the end of the millennium and after Christ had put down all the rest of his enemies. Well, when the Israelites rejected God as their king and demanded a king like all the other nations, God allowed them to set up Saul as their king, 1 Samuel 8, verse 7. But soon afterwards, God sent Samuel to anoint David as the successor, 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. From whose descendants a king, Jesus, would arise to take the kingdom away from the Jews and give it back to God to whom it belongs. And there's a list of passages here which I think we're not going to take the time to look up, but they're here for your own reference, and I would encourage you to read those. That'll help you understand what we're saying here about Jesus taking the kingdom away from the Jews, his enemies, putting his enemies down, crushing them, and taking the kingdom and giving it back to the Father to whom it belongs. Now, that's very interesting here. That's all in the background of what Paul is saying, but there's something even more interesting here about these verses here, which directly relates to the whole question of what kind of resurrection is under discussion here in 1 Corinthians 15. Notice the reference to the putting down of all enemies by Christ, the last of which was death itself. The commentaries connect this defeat of death here in 1 Corinthians 15 with the casting of death and Hades into the lake of fire that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 20. When we compare Paul's words here in 1 Corinthians 15 with John's words in Revelation 20, the similarity between them is astounding. It appears that both texts are talking about the same defeat of death at the parousia when the dead were raised. This means that we can use the information in Revelation 20 to help us understand 1 Corinthians 15. Revelation 20 mentions the raising of the dead ones out of Hades and the emptying of Hades before it was cast into the lake of fire. So the resurrection that occurred at the end of the millennium in Revelation chapter 20 was a resurrection of the dead ones out of Hades. It was that resurrection of the dead saints out of Hades which fully and finally defeated death and Hades once for all. Now, unless we want to posit a different final defeat of death in Revelation 20 than the final defeat mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, it means that Revelation 20 has to be talking about the same final defeat of death that 1 Corinthians 15 is. And notice that the resurrection in Revelation 20 was an emptying of Hades. It was a resurrection of the dead out of Hades. It doesn't give the slightest hint in Revelation 20 that is talking about a collective body being raised out of dead Judaism. That concept is totally alien and foreign to the context of Revelation 20. Yet Revelation 20 has to be talking about the same defeat of death that 1 Corinthians 15 is. And if so, that defeat of death was accomplished by the resurrection out of Hades. So if 1 Corinthians 15 is talking about the same final defeat of death and the resurrection that Revelation 20 is talking about, then it means that 1 Corinthians 15 is also talking about the resurrection of the dead ones out of Hades, just like Revelation 20 is. Do you catch the power of that? Now let's go on to verse 29, where Paul talks about a baptism for the dead. And you should read the amazing assortment of explanations that all the commentaries give for this baptism for the dead. Several commentaries, however, suggested that it refers to the Jewish burial custom of washing a dead body before burial to ensure that this individual would be resurrected. In the case of dead relatives whose bodies were lost at sea, consumed by fire, or eaten by wild animals, a very close blood relative was allowed to be washed on behalf of that dead relative to ensure his or her resurrection. Paul is neither approving nor condemning this burial custom, but rather simply wondering why the Corinthians were practicing it if they did not believe their dead relatives were going to be raised. Didn't make much sense to baptize them in order that they would be raised if they're not going to be raised at all. What's the point of practicing this vicarious baptism? Now, that makes a lot of sense to me, because it's very clear here that Paul is not sanctioning that custom of baptism for the dead. He's just simply commenting on the futility of it and the meaninglessness of it if, in fact, the dead are not going to be raised. Why baptize anybody for the dead if the dead are not going to be raised? Now, if you think that explanation is difficult to understand, you ought to try listening to the collective body folks and how they try to explain what this baptism for the dead is in their collective body view. That's one of the most contrived explanations I have ever heard. They have to twist that passage every which way in order to make their explanation of the baptism for the dead fit the collective body view. Now, in verses 30 through 32, Paul continues his argumentation here about why the dead have to be raised. He says, "Furthermore, if the dead are not going to be raised, and there was not going to be any conscious afterlife, then why was he and the other apostles suffering persecution and depriving themselves of this life's benefits and blessings? Why not rather indulge in all of life's pleasures to the maximum?" In verses 33 and 34, Paul rebuked the Corinthians for hanging around with evil company who were corrupting them, and for listening to some who do not have the knowledge of God. Boy, this points straight at those Greek philosophers. They were definitely ignorant about the God of the Jewish people and the Christians. And they were certainly evil folks, corrupt folks. They deserved this very description that Paul gives them here. It would not fit the resurrection deniers that the collective body guys are advocating, because those folks believed in a collective body resurrection. They just denied that the Old Testament Jewish dead would get to be a part of it. And so they were people who had some significant knowledge of God, and they were not evil company and evil folks. They knew enough about the collective body, which suggests that they were knowledgeable people. And so that would not fit the description that we see here that Paul gives of these folks who were denying the resurrection. So they must have been Greek-oriented philosophers who did not have any knowledge about the true God and who were evil in their behavior and were corrupting the Corinthian Christians. The Greek philosophers in Corinth and nearby Athens would certainly fit the description that Paul gives here. We remember that when Paul visited Athens, he noted how the city was full of idols, one of which was dedicated to the unknown God, which is an admission that they don't know much about the true God. Paul makes that very clear to them. He says, "Let me tell you about this God that you don't know anything about." The Greeks did not have a correct understanding of the true God, so it's not surprising that the Greek philosophers in Athens scoffed at Paul when he taught the resurrection of the dead. Therefore, it seems likely that it was Greek philosophers there in Corinth who were confusing the Corinthian saints by denying that the dead will be raised. It fits, and it does not fit the collective body view at all. It has to be talking about the Greek philosophers, and that means we're talking about an individual body resurrection view here, not a collective body. Collective body view just does not work in verses 33 and 34. Now let's look at verses 35 and following, where he gets into the seed analogy in answer to those resurrection deniers there who are asking a couple of questions about Paul's resurrection view. Some there in Corinth, who had been influenced by Greek philosophy to deny the resurrection, were asking these two questions. How are the dead raised, and with what kind of body do they come? Both questions suggest a strong Platonic influence. Paul answers both questions by using several analogies. He begins by comparing the resurrection to the sprouting of seed. He says, "What you sow is not made alive unless it dies." In essence, Paul was saying that a seed does not receive its new plant body until after the old seed body breaks open and is laid aside or dies. It is the same for the saint. We cannot get our new immortal bodies until after our mortal bodies have died. That is true, except for those saints who happen to still be alive at the time of the parousia, at which time the living were changed without having to experience death first. And we noted earlier that Paul deals with the living separately after he finishes his discussion about the resurrection of the dead ones in verses 51 and following. Now, some commentators are puzzled by Paul's statement here that the seed does not die until after it is sown, since they think that the sowing of the seed is the burial of the body. The implication is that people were being buried alive and didn't die until after they were buried. However, some commentators remind us that the sowing here is referring to the birth of the person into the world, not referring to his burial of his body. Thus, that means that Paul is saying that humans are sown into the world at their birth, and their physical bodies have to die before they can receive their new immortal bodies. In verses 37 through 38, Paul clearly says that the body in which we are sown is not the same body that we will have after the resurrection. Instead, he says, God gives it a body just as he wished, and to each of the seeds a body of its own. In other words, we are born, we live, and die in one kind of body, and come to life in a different kind of body, just like seeds do. Futurists, who take the bodies out of the graves view of resurrection, have real difficulty explaining these two verses here, verse 37 and verse 38. Paul, at least, is teaching two different kinds of bodies here in these two verses, if not, in fact, two different bodies altogether. But the very least we have to say is that he's teaching two different kinds of bodies when he says that God gives it a body just as he wished, and to each of the seeds a body of its own. Now, the traditional bodies out of the graves folks would say God doesn't need to give it another body. They've already got a body. And so it doesn't make much sense in a bodies out of the grave perspective. And you can see why they have real problems with verses 37 and 38. Paul here is at least teaching two different kinds of bodies, if not, in fact, two different bodies altogether. The latter concept is clinched, I believe, in verse 38, where Paul says that God gives a new body to each of the seeds. Thus, when the seed sprouts, the old seed body dies and returns to dust, while the new plant body rises up from the inner germ of the seed. Notice also that each of the seeds or individuals receives its own body. This does not work in the collective body view, but it perfectly fits the individual body view, which believes that each of the seeds gets its own new body, not merges into one big collective body. Then in verses 39 through 41, these verses further illustrate the point about the differences between seed bodies and plant bodies. There are different kinds of flesh and different levels of glory between terrestrial and celestial bodies, as well as between the sun, moon, and stars in the heavens. And so he's talking about different kinds of bodies in response to the Greeks, who just could not conceive of different kinds of bodies. They only thought there was one kind of body that humans could have, and that body had to be discarded at death and done away with because it was evil and bad, and they didn't want to spend eternity in an evil body, so they believed their afterlife was disembodied. But Paul shows that that's not necessary to get rid of a bodily afterlife, because there are different kinds of bodies. There is a good body. There is an immortal body that is worth spending eternity in. And so Paul is showing that there's different kinds of bodies, and that there is a good kind of body. And in verse 42, he picks up once again on that concept that was expressed in verses 37 and 38. He shows that just as seeds are not sown in their final plant body that they will have after they sprout, so it is with human resurrection. God gives it, which is referring to each individual seed, not the body. The it there is referring to the seed, the whole seed, including its inner germ and its outer shell. And notice he says here, God gives it, the seed itself, including its inner germ, each individual seed or person, a new body at the resurrection. The seed is sown into the world in a body that is subject to corruption, dishonor, and weakness, but it is raised in a body that is incorruptible, glorious, and powerful. The seed, or the individual person, is sown in a natural body, but is raised in a spiritual body. Notice again that Paul is speaking of individual seeds here, not about a collective body. In verses 45 through 49, Paul again emphasizes the fact that there are two different kinds of bodies, and that the natural body precedes the spiritual body. The first Adam was earthy and made of dust, just like we are in our natural bodies. The last Adam is from heaven and has a heavenly spiritual body, which is the bodily image the saints shall bear, future tense, after they are raised at the parousia. Notice again here, the future tense. Those saints were not already bearing the image of the heavenly man while they were still in their earthy, natural bodies of dust. They did not have two bodies at the same time. They would not put on and bear their new heavenly spiritual bodies until the resurrection. Notice the future tense. He says shall bear, not are bearing, present tense, but shall bear, future tense, after they are raised at the parousia. Clearly, this heavenly image is referring to a new kind of body that they each would receive at the parousia, one that would enable them to live in heaven with the heavenly man, Christ Jesus. It is interesting here in verse 49 that Paul does not distinguish between the living and the dead in bearing the image of the heavenly man. The implication is that both the dead and the living would put on their new heavenly spiritual bodies at the resurrection event. This implication becomes explicit in the next five verses, as we will see. In verses 50 through 54, some commentators believe that verses 50 through 53 are talking about the effect of the resurrection upon both groups, the living and the dead. Others think it is mainly a discussion about the bodily change of the living that occurs in the blink of an eye immediately after the dead are raised. Well, it really doesn't make much difference. Both views have the living and the dead put on their new immortal bodies at the resurrection change event. However, the key points that we must not overlook are the bodily change of the living and when it occurred. Note verses 51 and 52 in particular. Not all of those saints who were alive at the time Paul wrote in AD 57 would die. Some of them, Paul says, would remain alive until the last trump, when the dead will be raised, future tense, and those living saints shall be changed, future tense. Notice the future tense here for both the resurrection of the dead and the change of the living. They would occur in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, which was at the parousia. This was not an already ongoing process of dying, rising, reciprocity, resurrection, and change, but rather a future resurrection and change that would occur at the last trumpet in concert with the parousia. This future tense here does not fit the collective body view at all, but it perfectly fits the individual body view of resurrection and change. We know what the resurrection did for the dead saints. It raised them out of Hades and put them in heaven with their new immortal bodies. But what about the living saints? What was the bodily change that the living were going to experience at the parousia? Whatever it was supposed to occur at the last trump, right after the dead were raised. Unless we want to stretch out the sounding of the last trump for millennia or even eternity, then it means that the bodily change of the living took place in connection with the resurrection of the dead at the parousia, and is not ongoing after AD 70. Now, that means that some of our fellow preterists who are individual body view guys, but they reject the rapture idea, they want to stretch out this change after AD 70 and say that it's nothing more than the saints who died after 70 AD getting their bodily exchange when they die. But that's not what this text is saying. It says that this bodily change would happen to living people at the parousia, not to dead people after 70 AD. So unless we want to stretch out the sounding of the last trumpet for millennia or even eternity, then it means that the bodily change of the living took place in connection with the resurrection of the dead at the parousia, and is not an ongoing process after 70 AD. What was this change of the living? They need to answer that question. Verses 53 and 54 explain what it was. It was the putting on of incorruption and immortality. For the dead, whose bodies were already consumed in corruption, it meant putting on new bodies of incorruption. But for the living and remaining saints at the parousia, who were still wearing their flesh and blood mortal bodies, it meant putting on immortality, which swallowed up or changed their mortality into immortality. Paul clarifies this further in his second epistle to the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, which we looked at in our last session. And if you haven't listened to that last session, then you'll probably want to do so, because it'll give you a better explanation of this change than what we're providing here in this session. Well, that pretty much wraps up our study of Paul's resurrection teaching in his two epistles to the Corinthians. If any of this was unclear or confusing to you, don't hesitate to send me an email asking for more information about it. Some of our regular listeners in the past few months have asked me to do a series of studies on Paul's eschatological teaching in the book of Romans. I have wanted to teach a series on Romans for several years now, so this seems to be the right time and place to do it. Therefore, Lord willing, next time we will begin that series on Paul's eschatological teaching in his epistle to the church at Rome. And of course, that includes his teaching about the resurrection in chapter 8 of Romans. We're going to spend a lot of time on the context building up to it so that when we get to chapter 8, we'll understand what Paul is talking about. I would encourage all of us to start preparing for that series of studies on Romans by reading the book of Romans in several different translations. Become as familiar with the flow of Paul's thinking in Romans as you can before we study it together. That will make our studies here on the podcast much more meaningful and productive for you. And by the way, if you know of any commentaries on Romans that I might not be aware of, please send me an email about them and let me know about them, because I want to cover all the bases in my study preparation. Well, I think that'll just about wrap it up for this session. I appreciate you listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
This has been Then and Now with Ed Stevens. We would love to hear from you. Send your email to preterist1@preterist.org. Our website has many great articles, books, and audio video resources. The address is www.preterist.org. This teaching ministry depends on your donations and you share in all the good fruit that we produce. To make a donation or support monthly, simply go to our website, www.preterist.org, or call us at 814-368-6578. Join us again next time for Then and Now, where we study the past to shape a better future.